Welcome to the first May Sound Off of 2012. It is Sunday, May 6th. I am the Solomonster, and this is episode 217 of the Solomonster Sounds Off on sescoops.com. I want to thank everybody, as always, for joining me here on the podcast, and I want to also give a quick shout-out to all of the people who joined myself and Noah Mark this past Monday night, 1 hour before Raw. We had the big return of SC Scoops Live on the website. And we had a bunch of callers. We talked about Extreme Rules. We talked about Raw coming up that night. So I want to give a shout-out to Jacob from Wichita, Vince from Ontario, and all the people who listened to this show who also called into the live show on Monday night. Me and Noah had a lot of fun. We had a run-in on the show, a call from a beloved person in Brian Blade. So it was a really fun time. We hope to do more of that in the future. The plan was to perhaps try to do one before Raw once a month, the night after a pay-per-view. I'm not sure if we're sticking to that or if we're going to change things up a little bit. There will be another show sometime in the future. We'll let you guys know when that might be. We've got a lot to get to this week. First thing I want to mention here is the Mayweather-Cotto fight from last night on pay-per-view. I did catch the fight, and I caught the Triple H appearance. Triple H actually seconded Floyd Mayweather on his way down to the ring along with Justin Bieber. So we had the tag team of Triple H and Justin Bieber together in Vegas last night for the big boxing match. That was quite surreal. Triple H carrying one of Floyd Mayweather's titles. Of course, Mayweather, a big WWE fan, became very friendly, I'm sure, with Triple H and a lot of people behind the scenes when he worked with the Big Show a couple years ago at WrestleMania. There was even some talk back then that Mayweather may be contemplating a WWE career for himself, which I suppose he still could do when his boxing days are over, although he's 35 now, not getting any younger. So there was Triple H in Vegas last night sporting a brace on his supposedly injured left arm. So I'm not quite sure that somebody with a broken arm, as he has, should be walking around like that, bumping into people in Vegas. But at least he had the brace on, so he was trying to maintain the storyline to some degree. So that was cool. As for the fight was actually pretty good. I don't know that Mayweather was... I shouldn't say that. I mean, Mayweather did come out of one of those rounds in a lot of trouble. I forgot which round it was. But really, overall, it was Mayweather's fight. He did win. It was competitive at moments. The crowd was really into it. I guess, you know, Mayweather makes a great heel, even if he wasn't acting like it last night. He was very conciliatory towards Larry Merchant, who, as knowledgeable as he may be, Larry Merchant's best days, if he ever really had any best days, are long gone. Having to listen to this guy on commentary is just torture. It's absolutely torture. And him doing those live post-fight interviews where he stands there and he just takes forever to ask the questions, it's sad. And in a lot of ways, I think that, you know, Larry Merchant standing there kind of fumbling around and trying to come up with questions to ask Floyd Mayweather and talking really slowly, in a lot of ways is a great metaphor for the state of boxing. You know, were it not for fighters like Mayweather and Pacquiao, I don't know where boxing really would be right now. A lot of people say that, you know, boxing's best days are behind it, and, you know, mixed martial arts is the new way to go. I thought looking at Larry Merchant standing there like a bewildered, lost old man was a great metaphor for that. But Mayweather is great at what he does. He's great at promoting. And if we ever do get that Mayweather-Pacquiao fight, I think it will probably, safe to say that you'll probably have some new pay-per-view records set if that fight ever happens, which I remain unconvinced that fight is ever going to happen. The other thing I wanted to mention is that I finally had a chance to sit down and watch the Davey Richards-Michael Elgin match from Ring of Honor Showdown in the Sun. I believe it was night two. That was from WrestleMania weekend in Fort Lauderdale. It was for the Ring of Honor World Heavyweight Championship. What a fantastic match. This was a great match, and you know, as with a lot of Ring of Honor matches, this is a small criticism, but I have to mention it. As with a lot of Ring of Honor main events in particular, I thought there were way too many kicks to the head for near falls. It just seems like there's just so many kicks to the head and kicks to the chest. You know, by the time you've seen the 12th kick to the head, you know, it kind of loses its meaning a little bit. Still, it was a great match. Michael Elgin really impressed me here. That may be more of a credit to Davey Richards, as great as Elgin is. Richards is probably that much better. I mean, you know, surprise, surprise, Davey Richards is a very good pro wrestler. I know that's news to everybody. But Elgin really came off like a star in this match. This was a star-making effort for him here. And there was one point in the match, it was actually the last like 30 seconds to a minute of the match, where Elgin kicked out of what else? He kicked out of a kick to the head after like one, and got up to his knees, all fired up, and he spat at Davey Richards. I mean, you have to see this moment. This got the crowd so fired up. It's a shame the match ended like 10 seconds later, but I was into this match at certain points where I was even practically cheering just watching it on my laptop. So, really great stuff. But again, if I had to make a minor complaint about the match, and it's not just this match. I think a lot of Ring of Honor main events that I've seen, especially when I used to go to the shows, you know, more often, and it was great. You'd be exhausted by the time the night was over, but there's just way too many kicks. And I know a lot of these guys, some of them at least, are very you know, proficient in mixed martial arts, and they train in other kind of disciplines, and they're not just pro wrestlers per se, so they incorporate a lot of that into their repertoire. Even Davey Richards, I think, made a comment. He had a post-match speech, and he said something to the effect of, I think his body belongs to MMA, but his heart belongs to pro wrestling or something. So I get that you're going to see a lot of that type of thing. I just think it's way overdone. And again, it loses some of its effectiveness. And case in point, the finish of this match. As great as this match was, the finish of the match was a kick to the head. Now, after everything that these guys put each other through, I mean, these guys punished each other in this match with just ridiculous moves beyond the kicks. It was just incredible stuff, and yet here we are kind of building to the climax of this match. And like I said, there was this one moment at the end where Elgin kicks out of something at the count of one, gets up on his knees, is all fired up, spits at Richards, and Richards comes back at him with some more stuff. And it just felt like this one random kick to the head out of nowhere from Davey Richards got the three count. It seemed to catch the crowd a little bit off guard, even though they gave them a standing ovation, and rightfully so, at the end of the match. But that finish is a great example of what I'm talking about, where the finish just kind of came out of nowhere. It almost didn't make any sense after all the punishment that these guys put each other through, and the different submissions and the suplexes and dropping each other on their heads for just some random kick that we had seen all throughout the match to kind of end it was almost anticlimactic, but not enough to ruin the match or anything like that. So I'm glad I finally had a chance to watch it. I heard nothing but good things about it. People were just raving about it. They were calling it match of the year. You have to see it. Best match I've ever seen, so I finally watched it. I wouldn't say it was the best match I've ever seen. I'd say it's certainly a contender for match of the year so far. Probably up there for me anyway, with Lesnar and Cena at Extreme Rules, and probably Sheamus and Daniel Bryan as well, which was my favorite match of the pay-per-view. We'll talk about that in a second. It's two totally different styles. Some people might hear that and go, you're crazy comparing Lesnar and, you know, comparing a John Cena match to what we saw with Davey Richards and Michael Elgin. It's two different styles. You know, WWE has their style. Ring of Honor has a very particular style in their main events, and they're very different, but you could still, you know, match of the year is a very subjective thing, and you can certainly factor the drama of it and other things into it, not just the wrestling itself, but this match was way up there. So if you have an opportunity to check out the show, find the match online, whatever means you may be able to find, it's certainly worth your time. The match is just under half an hour, so a pretty long match, but by no means the longest Ring of Honor match I've ever seen. So certainly if you can take 25 or 30 minutes of your time, it would be time well spent. So with that, let's get into Extreme Rules. We did talk about the pay-per-view a little bit on Monday night with Noah. I went over some of my predictions and how I fared. I didn't go into all of my thoughts here. I want to share that with you now. For the record, I went 4-2 in my predictions for Extreme Rules, which, By all accounts, if you take some of my recent predictions into consideration, not a bad batting average, 4-2. Of course, that doesn't factor in the two bonus matches that WWE added to the pay-per-view. I thought this was probably the best WWE B-show pay-per-view since Money in the Bank last year, which ironically was also held in Chicago with a hot crowd, I think in that same arena, in fact. This may have been a better show than WrestleMania, from top to bottom. I certainly had more fun being at WrestleMania, given everything that we were able to do and the seats we had and, you know, the pomp and the circumstance and being with, you know, 80,000 people. Obviously, my impressions are going to be very different from, say, somebody who watched the show at home on TV. But as a pay-per-view card from top to bottom in terms of match quality, those three top matches on the show delivered. Every single one of those matches delivered. It's hard to argue that this pay-per-view wasn't the best of the year so far. You had a fantastic World Heavyweight Championship match. You had a very good WWE title match. And you had a brutal, bloody main event that was really unlike anything that we are accustomed to seeing on WWE television these days in the so-called PG era. I think I used the expression on SE Scoops Live, an absolute demolition derby. And one other thing I mentioned on SE Scoops Live, I have a note here, and I got to mention it here again because you got to be fair, it's worth noting. I felt that Michael Cole deserves praise because he was pretty good on the show, but particularly during the main event. You know, Cole's whole shtick has been dialed back. Supposedly, you know, the end of his kind of heel character, if you want to call it that, was supposed to be at WrestleMania. He still has heelish tendencies. He hasn't dropped that entirely, but you can tell that his act is very much toned down from what it was even just a couple of months ago, and it really helps. Because Michael Cole, at his core, he's not a bad announcer. I think his days with Taz on SmackDown prove that he could be a good wrestling announcer. He'll never necessarily be the best of the best. He may never be a Jim Ross or a Gordon Solie or anything like that, but he can be very good when he wants to be. And I felt that his performance in that main event at the pay-per-view showed that. And I don't know if it's because Brock Lesnar back in the day was a SmackDown guy, and again, Cole and Taz were the ones who called most of Brock Lesnar's matches during his initial WWE run. But to me, it felt right having Michael Cole out there calling a Brock Lesnar match, and I thought he did a hell of a job. So I just wanted to put that out there in all fairness. Let's start with the top match on the pay-per-view. Makes sense here. Brock Lesnar and John Cena, they had an Extreme Rules match. I thought this was an awesome main event until the finish. Just complete destruction. Everything this match was supposed to be, it was. It was almost unimaginable to me that WWE could put this match on in that fashion because it just seemed like they were doing everything right. You know, right out of the gate, Cena goes after Lesnar. Lesnar takes him down right away. Within the first 30 seconds of the match, John Cena is busted open. I mean, that right there is enough of a reason to give this match a thumbs up. And Cena comes back at Brock. Brock takes him right back down, bloodies him up a little bit more. The doctors are in there checking on Cena. I mean, this was just perfect stuff. Absolutely perfect stuff. The elbows from Lesnar were just brutal. The, you know, tying Cena's legs together with a chain and hanging him from the post, wiping Cena's blood on his chest and then licking it. It reminded me, actually, him licking the blood reminded me of Jimmy Jacobs, who would do that sort of thing a lot in Ring of Honor before, where he licks other people's blood, and it's just, ugh, so gross. But anyway, scariest part of the match for me, besides the finish, had to be Lesnar flying, soaring over the top rope and crashing to the floor. It was a botched spot. I think it was pretty obvious, because they pretty much went right back to the same spot again, that being where Cena caught him with the chain right in the head. But man, you talk about a scary moment. I mean, it was just, it looked like it sucked for Brock. He was favoring his knee. It looked like he may have torn something. My heart sank at that point. Talk about flushing money down the toilet, even though they ended up doing that anyway. Thankfully, if he did get hurt, it could not have been too bad. He was up. He was smiling. People were cheering. But you talk about scary sights in life. The thought of Brock Lesnar flying towards me is something that would probably have piss running down my leg. I think the scariest thing that ever flew at me before was a water bug. I wasn't aware that these disgusting little creatures can fly. I found out the hard way one day. But I think if Brock Lesnar were flying at me, that might be a little bit scarier. Maybe. I don't like bugs. As for the finish, having Brock Lesnar lose to John Cena in his very first match back, when you have the potential for so many other money matches with the guy, was the wrong decision. Flat out, wrong decision. You cannot convince me otherwise. Unless you were bringing Brock Lesnar in for exactly one match to put over your top guy, then fine. But clearly he's not in it for one match. He is supposedly signed to a one-year deal. He was back on TV the next night. It was the wrong decision to make. I cannot help but think that it was a lost opportunity for them on this show, because you have to believe that they had a lot of extra eyeballs. I don't know what the buy rate is. We'll find out shortly the early estimates on the buy rate, but whatever the number is, you have to know that there were extra eyeballs on this show that you would not ordinarily have, whether it was former WWE fans, whether it was MMA fans who wanted to tune in to see Brock Lesnar's big wrestling comeback. People at bars apparently were really into the match, and people that you would not ordinarily expect to watch a WWE show. So there was a lot of potential there. And will John Cena beating Brock dissuade those people from buying future shows? I would think so. I mean, I guess we'll find out. But the bottom line here is that Lesnar did destroy Cena. For most of the match, WWE did everything right. He got a visual pin on Cena at one point after an F5. There was no big Superman comeback. There were no flying shoulder blocks. There was no five-knuckle shuffle. Cena really only won the match by the skin of his teeth. The real story was that John Cena needed to use a steel chain and the ring steps to pin Brock Lesnar, which was perfectly legal. It was an Extreme Rules match. But he needed help. That, to me, is the real story. And I thought this was the best WWE pay-per-view main event as far as a match quality is concerned, since CM Punk beat Miz and Del Rio in December in that TLC match, which I thought that match also, for me, exceeded expectations. So did this one. This was great stuff. It's worth noting also that, you know, John Cena really doesn't get enough credit for these big matches, even though I think the outcome was all completely wrong. I really think that people don't give John Cena, in a lot of ways, the credit he deserves when it comes to these big money pay-per-view matches. I mean, if he took a ton of abuse in this match with Brock. He had a very good match with The Rock at WrestleMania. He had a great 40-minute match with CM Punk at Money in the Bank last year. He's had great battles with Umaga. I remember a Last Man Standing match at the Royal Rumble one year between them that was actually very good. JBL. That I Quit match, I think from it was Judgment Day in 2005. Talk about bloody. That was a hell of a match. Edge, he's had some wars with Edge, including that TLC match that Edge referenced on Raw when Cena beat him in Toronto. Batista, both matches that Cena has had with Batista have been pretty good matches. Shawn Michaels, including the 50-minute UK match. And again, it's Shawn Michaels, true, but you know, it takes two to tango, as they say. So John Cena has a pretty impressive record when you really stop and look at it in terms of big matches that turn out to be pretty goddamn great. And you have to give the guy at least some credit for that. So this match with Brock was excellent. Brock deserves a lot of credit for that, but so does Cena, in my opinion. And I don't really feel that he's getting enough of that, so I just wanted to mention that here. After the match, Cena grabbed the microphone. He cut a very odd promo about taking a vacation, going away for a while. He told everybody to get home safe. It was a promo that was, it seemed designed to take place off the air, only it happened on TV. And supposedly nobody knew that Cena was going to cut that promo. It was not in the script, it was not in the notes. Vince McMahon and everybody backstage at least pretended to be taken aback by it. It really didn't make any sense at all. Especially looking back on it now, to put that on TV, not after the beating he took. Brock Lesnar apparently flipped his shit backstage. He felt double-crossed, which is not the first time he's felt this way. If you remember my book review a couple weeks ago, Brock felt the same way about The Rock and all the agents at that house show in Miami when he was booked to lose to The Rock in their second match. He claims that he was told, Brock was, that Cena would be going out on a stretcher, which really, to me, that doesn't make sense. Because if Brock knew he was losing, and apparently he did for a couple of weeks, why would the babyface go out on a stretcher? It just doesn't make sense to me. Unless there was some sort of post-match beatdown, if both guys were going to go out on a stretcher given the beating they took, I guess that would make sense. But if it was just going to be Cena using a chain to beat Brock, and the babyface goes over and everybody celebrates, and it's just hard for me to picture the big top babyface in the company going out on a stretcher. It just seems to me like unless there was something, you know, his leg was broken or something like that, I wouldn't have bought it, quite frankly, that Cena would be going out on a stretcher. But supposedly that's what he was told. He felt that his botched tumble over the top rope when he almost killed himself was caused by Cena pulling down the top rope. He was really hot at John Laurinaitis' assistant and supposedly came very close to quitting. I'm not sure how much of this is a work and how much of this is a shoot. I would imagine that Brock was genuinely upset about falling out of the ring and Cena cutting that promo, but him quitting barely 1 month into a multi-million dollar deal, I don't buy it. I don't buy it. We had Nikki Bella and Layla. I'm going in reverse order here, by the way. WWE Divas Championship. Would have made perfect sense here to have Karma make her return at the very show where she debuted last year, take out the Bellas, who we last saw ripping Karma on Raw a year ago before she went away. So, naturally, they did not do that. From what I can gather, they had that plan. That was the plan at one point, to have Karma come back on this show, and they apparently changed it, feeling that everyone thought it was going to be Karma anyway, so let's swerve them. Let's swerve everybody and make them look foolish. They had Karma go on Twitter during the show, I noticed, and she basically teased that she was going to come out and kill the Bellas without actually saying it. And then later on, when Layla was revealed as the opponent for Nikki Bella, Karma went back on Twitter and tweeted that she was actually at home and never actually said that she would be in Chicago. So, whatever. You know, this basically resulted in the crowd not giving a shit and chanting Karma throughout the entire match. And Layla looked good. She really did, both literally and figuratively. She looked good, and she won the championship in her first match back. But again, nobody cared. And, you know, if that really was going to be it for the Bellas in WWE, which it wasn't, they did appear on Raw the next night, they had the perfect opportunity to tie up their story with Karma by having Karma just destroy them and sending them on their way, and they didn't do it, apparently because everybody already knew that was going to happen. I'm going to have more to say about this during the Raw review, but this was not what it should have been. Let's put it that way. CM Punk and Chris Jericho in a street fight for the WWE Championship. Another decisive win for CM Punk, and in his hometown to boot. So there Punk goes again, bucking the trend of people who ordinarily would be crushed in their hometowns. And Punk now has two big wins in Chicago in less than a year. Punk did not quite get the rabid response he got last July, but still got a pretty good response. I mean, he was cheered like crazy. The match was very good. I felt it was the third best match on the entire show. I like the fact that he and Jericho both came out dressed up in jeans with taped fists, as they should be for a street fight. It was kind of goofy, I guess, for Jericho to walk out wearing his light, bright jacket while dressed for a street fight. But to be fair, the jacket he wore at the pay-per-view was quite awesome. Punk's mother and sister were at ringside. Conspicuous by his absence, though, was Punk's father. And I can only assume that he must have fallen off the wagon and was watching the match from a nearby sports bar. Punk's sister was actually pretty cute. I was left wondering exactly what drug she was addicted to. It didn't look like meth, since she doesn't have that meth addict face. Maybe she's hooked on prescription meds. So between this and the main event, we can say that this pay-per-view lived up to its name for a change. Jericho put a picture up on Twitter after the match that showed all the welts on his back from those Singapore cane shots, the kendo stick shots, just brutal stuff. And Punk wins. Jericho is now 0-4 on pay-per-view since coming back in January. So he's got some work to do if he wants to get a win before he goes away again. There was a squash match on pay-per-view. Jay Hatton and Aaron Relic got killed by Ryback. You know, I'm all for TV squashes, but not on a show that I paid $44.95 to see. Ryback got a ton of Goldberg chants. Well, I mean, in fairness, he is doing the Goldberg gimmick, so I guess that makes sense. He killed these poor bastards, one of whom sounded exactly like Brother Love in their pre-match promo, to the point where I had to do a double take and just check and make sure like it wasn't like Brother Love's son or Brother Love himself, who, of course, is now with TNA, so that's not possible. But I thought he sounded an awful lot like him. Maybe not now, after being clotheslined and killed by Ryback. I don't know if he's even got a voice box anymore after that. So, whatever. This was what it was. I really could have done without this on pay-per-view. Sheamus and Daniel Bryan, 2 out of 3 falls match for the World Heavyweight Championship. This right here was Daniel Bryan's coming out party. If anybody in the back still had doubts as to how good this guy really is, this match should have erased those doubts. Aside from the spectacle of the main event, this was the best match on the entire show. I mean, as a wrestling match, this was just fantastic. In terms of a WWE match, this just doesn't get any better than this. It told a great story, had Bryan working over Sheamus' shoulder. Bryan actually lost the first fall after repeatedly kicking Sheamus' arm while he was trapped in the ropes, and he refused to break for the 5 count. Speaking of which, I was very happy to see Daniel Bryan bring back the old I have till 5 spot. during the match with the referee. He used to do that a lot in Ring of Honor where, you know, he'd be beating somebody up, the referee would be counting, and he would stop and yell at them and put his hand up and say, "I have till five." And this was the first time I noticed him doing it in WWE. Second fall had Bryan beat Sheamus with the Yes Lock after Sheamus passed out in the hold. The crowd was totally into this. They were chanting yes, they were chanting no, repeatedly, while doctors checked on Sheamus in between falls. And Sheamus, being the valiant babyface champion, he struggled to his feet. He said that he could continue, and he ended up beating Bryan with the bro kick to win the match, exactly the outcome I expected. There was no AJ to interfere or anything like that. She showed up backstage briefly, and that was it. Just a great back-and-forth wrestling match that we should have gotten at WrestleMania. And this time they had time to go out there and do their thing, and I give this two thumbs up. This was the best match on the entire show. Again, aside from the spectacle of the main event, which was different. But this was great. This was just great stuff. Big Show and Cody Rhodes, tables match for the Intercontinental Championship. Cody won the belt back on a fluke when he kicked Big Show's leg off the apron. Show accidentally put his foot through a table that was set up on the floor. And Big Show's facial expression when he realized that he lost the match was priceless. Priceless. I love this finish. I know I shouldn't, because it's a great example of here's Cody Rhodes, you know, a young guy they're supposedly trying to push, although of late, I don't know, this is an odd way to push somebody, but, you know, this win didn't do anything for Cody Rhodes. It didn't make him look strong. It didn't make him look like a real champion, but I don't care. This was a great finish. Big Show's face, the reaction of the crowd, because when the crowd realized what had happened, it's kind of like Randy Orton and Christian at Money in the Bank last year in that same building. You know, they had a world championship match, and remember, the stipulation in that match was if Randy Orton got disqualified, if he let his temper get the best of him, then Christian would win the title, which, again, is kind of a fluky way for somebody to win the championship. That's not a way that Christian comes out of it looking, you know, really strong or superior to Randy Orton. But what happened in that match is Christian spit in Orton's face, Orton flipped his lid, went after Christian, kicked him low, and the referee called for the disqualification. Now think about this. Somebody kicks somebody in the groin, and the referee calls for a DQ in a world title match on pay-per-view. And if you recall, the crowd exploded when that happened because they knew. They knew right away exactly what had happened. They wanted Christian to win the championship, and it was huge. People reacted huge to it. So this was not quite on that level, but this was similar in that it's a bullshit finish, don't get me wrong. But when the people realized what had happened, they popped huge for it because they wanted Cody to win the belt, and he did. So, in my opinion, this was a great finish. After the match, Big Show gave him a choke slam, which almost felt like a heel turn. Seemed like Big Show was being a bit of a sore loser here, but not because it was an actual heel turn. But again, the people in Chicago, by and large, love Cody, and they responded accordingly by booing the Big Show. And to add insult to injury, or in this case, I'd say injury to injury, Show press slammed Cody out of the ring and threw a table on the outside. And that looked like it sucked for Cody Rhodes, but he was a champ for taking that bump. Less jolly Big Show and more mean, angry Big Show is something I could certainly get behind. Cody, by the way, ever the valiant champion, refused help and struggled back to his feet after the match, which I thought was a bit odd for a heel. But there you go. Brodus Clay and Dolph Ziggler had an impromptu match. Anyone who listens to my shows knows that I'm a fan of Brodus, but I may be a bigger fan of Dolph Ziggler, so to see him getting squashed like this makes me very sad. He made the finish look like $1 million here. The way he sold that headbutt to the sternum I thought was great. Big splash by Brodus, 1-2-3, not much more to it than that. This was probably the most competitive match I think Brodus has had with this gimmick to date in WWE. I'm totally fine with them adding Hornswoggle to his act. If in a couple of months they do a big heel turn and just have Brodus squash the hell out of the guy, like King Kong Bundy style at WrestleMania 3 with Little Beaver. You know, although the little guy didn't come out with Brodus on Raw, so I'm not sure what that means, but maybe he saw the heel turn coming too and wisely decided to get away now before it was too late. Randy Orton and Kane had a Falls Count Anywhere match. I was surprised they gave this match as much time as they did. This went almost 20 minutes. This opened the show. But, you know, for what it was, I thought it was fine. I'm always a sucker for backstage brawls when guys go backstage and it spills into the dressing room, it spills into the bathroom. I love that stuff. So I did enjoy that part of it. They made sure to make Zack Ryder look like a fool here, which I think has to happen on every show. As soon as I saw Zach, I crossed it off my checklist. I put a little check mark in the box that says Zach Ryder gets beaten up and embarrassed. So that was the part of the show here where that happened. He was raining blows down upon Kane from behind. Had absolutely no effect. Kane no-sold it. Was about to kill him. But he got saved by Randy Orton. And so Orton and Kane brawled back to the ring. And in the end, Orton delivered an RKO to Kane on a steel chair and got the pin. Let us hope that is the end of this wretched feud once and for all. There was one other match here. It was the YouTube pre-show match. It was Santino Marella defending the United States Championship against The Miz. Miz cut a promo about how last year at Extreme Rules he was in the main event defending his WWE title, and this year he's on the pre-show. And I figured he was going over here just because, really, how much lower can the dude go? Plus, he seems to be building some momentum of late. He's been getting some wins, and, well, so much for that. Santino beat him with a Cobra. He retained the title. And, well, hey, at least Miz got the lead role in the next Marine film. That's something, I guess. And that was Extreme Rules. So, I thought, again, the top three matches delivered. Everything else was fine. Some of the stuff wasn't particularly great, but the key matches delivered. Big. I felt they really delivered in a big way, so... I give this show a thumbs up. I thought this was a very good show. And that leads into Monday Night Raw. The very next night, Raw emanating from Dayton, Ohio, the site of the first King of the Ring pay-per-view in 93 at the Nutter Center, the site of Bret the Hitman Hart's WWE comeback a couple years ago. Was at the in Dayton. I don't know if it was the same building. I would imagine it was. WWE usually runs the same building in these cities when they go there. So just some history in Dayton. Three big developments on this show. First, Brock Lesnar broke Triple H's arm and is seemingly fired. Daniel Bryan won a beat-the-clock challenge to earn a shot at CM Punk's WWE Championship at Over the Limit. And John Cena is, in fact, not taking a vacation after all, and will face John Laurinaitis in the main event of the next pay-per-view, thus proving that it was never really about Lesnar versus Cena as much as it was all about Cena and Laurinaitis. Brock Lesnar was merely a stepping stone to Big Johnny. Think about that. In a rare example of storyline consistency, the show started with a graphic at the end of the opening montage that read, Monday Night Raw, starring Brock Lesnar. That was quite great. Laryngitis came to the ring. He raved about how Brock Lesnar handled John Cena the night before, gave him the worst beating of his life. Out came Brock, who started talking about how last night he brought the pain to John Cena. You would think that he actually won the match based on all of this so far, but in fact, he did not. And Lesnar was quickly interrupted by Triple H's music. Out came the COO. The gist of this was Laurinaitis did not have the power to authorize all of the contract demands that he gave into Brock last week, and Triple H was here to tell Lesnar that he was no longer getting the name of the show changed. He was no longer getting the limo service or the private plane. He said, if Brock wants to stay, then he can stay. He wants Brock to stay and have matches with guys like Sheamus and Randy Orton, but it's going to have to be under the terms of the original deal he signed. And Laurinaitis kept interrupting Hunter. Triple H turned his back to Lesnar at one point, and that was the cue for Brock to attack him from behind. Never turn your back on Brock Lesnar. And Lesnar gave Triple H some shoulder blocks in the corner. Hunter fought back. Then he got taken down in a Kimura, or as Nigel McGuinness would say, a Kimura. I noticed that during the Davey Richards-Michael Elgin match. I'm listening to Kevin Kelly and Nigel McGuinness on commentary, and Nigel at one point was calling it a Kimura, so I thought that was kind of funny. Anyway, Brock put the Kimura on Triple H and supposedly broke his arm. A bunch of baby faces ran down to the ring, Big Show, R-Truth, and they chased off Brock Lesnar. This was awesome. This was just really good stuff. It was actually the best segment on the entire show. And that's not necessarily a good thing. When the first segment of a two-hour show is as good as it's going to get, that's not good. But this was great stuff. It sets up a match down the road between Brock Lesnar and Triple H, which would be their first ever encounter. I think the only time that Lesnar and Triple H were ever in the ring together, it was during a triple threat match with Rock at the Global Warning pay-per-view down in Australia back in like 2002. And I don't really recall Brock and Triple H having too much interaction in that match. I think it was mostly Rock and Triple H and Rock and Brock. So this would really be the first time for sure that these guys have ever had a singles match. And with them claiming that the arm is broken, SummerSlam would seem to make sense. They actually came back the next day on the website and announced that Hunter's arm was not really broken. He would just be in a sling for a couple of weeks. And so somewhere between then and yesterday, somebody changed their mind, apparently, because WWE.com later announced that, in fact, Triple H's arm is broken and will require surgery. They said WWE medical officials were initially optimistic that the fracture in Triple H's left arm could be treated non-invasively, but further examination revealed that the break, in addition to severe ligament and tendon damage around the elbow, would necessitate surgical repair. Maybe I'm wrong. I don't remember them really calling it a break at all in the initial report. Maybe they did. But anyway, I mentioned earlier, Triple H was at the Mayweather fight last night, sporting a brace on his left arm. As for the eventual match between these two men, we know how this story ends, folks. We know how it ends. I didn't think Triple H would beat CM Punk last year, and he did. I still can't figure out, quite frankly, why he did, but he did. So I predict Triple H will, in fact, beat Brock Lesnar in their eventual match. I think it's just it's a foregone conclusion at this point. And until that time, I have decided that I am just going to continue to enjoy Brock's appearances, however many he may make each month. You know, the guy has a presence that nobody else on the roster has. It's actually quite refreshing. He lost some of that edge by losing to John Cena, for sure. What happens after he loses to The Game? I don't know. But, you know, hey, they can still do a match with Rock or Undertaker at next year's WrestleMania, but it ain't going to do record numbers like they did this year. I can guarantee you that. The shine is already off Brock Lesnar. And so, whatever. You know, Triple H and Brock will have a match at some point. I'm sure it'll be a good match. And like I said, the outcome is preordained, as far as I'm concerned. Until somebody convinces me otherwise, I'm fairly certain that Triple H will beat Brock Lesnar, whenever that may be. I presume SummerSlam, who knows, maybe they rush it onto the June pay-per-view or something. I find it funny how Triple H manages to finagle his way into the CM Punk storyline last summer, with the hottest act in the company at that time. And here he is again, involved in a storyline with Brock Lesnar, the latest hot act on the roster. Lesnar and Triple H is a marquee match, no question. I just think it's funny. That's all. Eve Torres announced the number one contender for CM Punk's WWE title would be determined in a beat-the-clock challenge. First match had Miz getting his win back over Santino from the night before in 4 minutes 18 seconds, so that was the time to beat. We then had a triple threat match with Layla defending her women's championship over the Bella Twins. She beat them in what had to have been 10 seconds. I mean, this may have been the best example yet of everything that is wrong with the Divas division. The bell rang, the Bellas argued, Layla rolled one of them up, got the pin, match over. I literally shouted, "That's it?" That was literally, I know I shouldn't be surprised by this, but I just could not believe it. And Nikki and Brie were fired by Eve in a backstage segment that aired on YouTube. So that's the end of them. I guess Karma will have to hunt them down on the indie scene if she wants to get her revenge. Can you imagine what kind of movie director Vince McMahon would make? Normally in a movie, you pay off the story in the end. So, you know, even if it's predictable, you do it because you want to please the audience so more people will pay to go see it and will want to see your movies in the future. Vince would direct the next Twilight film and proceed to kill off all the main characters in the first 20 minutes because the people who read the books already know how it's supposed to end. So you see, we need to swerve them and prove that they don't know shit. He would direct The Dark Knight Rises, kill off Batman in the opening scene, and just replace him with Aquaman for the rest of the movie and say, "See? Bet you didn't see that one coming." All right, enough of that. Chris Jericho and Big Show went to a draw in the next Beat the Clock match. I didn't hear any mention of the fact that these two men were tag team partners only a couple of years ago. Actually, one of the best teams they've had in years was Jericho. They, for at least a certain period of time, they did restore some value to the tag team titles, of which they now have none. Jericho was supposed to win this match. The referee fucked up the finish. They had to go to a commercial break to sort everything out. Wouldn't want to be that referee, having to walk back through the curtain. Not surprisingly, supposedly, Vince McMahon was furious with the finish. And between that and the supposedly unauthorized promo that John Cena cut the night before at the pay-per-view, he wants things in the future to be more controlled and rehearsed. Great. That's great. Brodus Clay beat JTG in another squash. this is starting to get ridiculous now. They really got to find something else for Brodus to do here. Hornswoggle, as I alluded to earlier, was not with him, and that was a plus. After the match, Brodus brought some kids into the ring to dance. That was cute. Randy Orton beat Jack Swagger in the next Beat the Clock match. I groaned when I saw Swagger. It's sad that that's the reaction I now have whenever I see him. Orton beat him with an RKO, so Orton bumped Miz as the new leader. R-Truth and Kofi Kingston then beat Primo and Epico to win the two pennies. This was actually a pretty good match. Primo in particular looked really good here. The titles mean less than nothing, so their attempt to make a big deal out of Kofi and Truth winning them fell kind of flat to me. It has since been announced on Twitter that Abraham Washington has signed Primo, Epico, and Rosa to his new All-World Enterprise faction. And I like how he signed them after they lost the titles. Way to go there, champ. Kane and the goddamn Great Khali had a beat-the-clock match. I shit you not. This was just fascinating to watch. Fascinating in the same way that drinking battery acid would be to see how it compares to heartburn. They actually had these two guys go to a draw, which meant they wrestled for nearly 5 minutes. Do you know how long 5 minutes is for a match on Raw these days? That's like half an Iron Man match. And they had these guys go 5 minutes without a winner, no less. No winner. Afterwards, Kane chokeslammed Khali and left. Oh, God, I hope that doesn't mean this is going to be Kane's new feud. Oh, God. As much as I want Kane and Orton to be over, I would almost beg for a Kane-Randy Orton match if the plan is to put Kane and the Great Khali together for a feud. I pray that is not what they have in mind. Daniel Bryan beat Jerry the King Lawler in the final Beat the Clock match and did so with 2 minutes left to spare, making him the number one contender for the WWE title. Punk came out on stage. Both men smiled at one another. I know these guys had like 3 or 4 consecutive matches on TV earlier this year, but I would not mind watching them another 3 or 4 times. I actually pitched Bryan as the potential next opponent for Punk on SE Scoops Live on Monday before Raw. So I was very happy with this outcome. That's going to be a hell of a match at the pay-per-view. John Cena came out with his arm in a sling for the main event, but was otherwise his usual jolly self. You would think after the beating this guy took, his head was just pouring blood. His arm was supposedly broken, but he was happy as always. His vacation ended after exactly 24 hours, but you didn't really think he was going away, did you? Come on. Come on. How long have you been listening to this podcast? You should know better. Cena said there is a difference between being injured and being hurt. His arm is severely, not severely, he said his arm is merely strained, not broken, and thus he is A-okay. John Laurinaitis came back out, said that he had a new opponent in mind for John Cena. Cena postulated that perhaps it could be Zeus, the human wrecking machine. Nobody reacted to this. Bad omen for the no-holds-barred DVD right there. Instead, out came Lord Tensai with Sakamoto, the man who has more wins over John Cena this year than does Brock Lesnar. And Tensai and Sakamoto both distracted Cena, allowing John Laurinaitis to clobber Cena from behind with a microphone. It was a swerve. Laurinaitis, the GM of both Raw and SmackDown, announced that he would be challenging John Cena at Over the Limit, not Tensai. And they laid a beating on Cena here with Laurinaitis stomping on his injured arm on the ring steps and smashing a steel chair across it. Not for nothing, but Big Johnny actually showed some fire in his attack on John Cena. It was kind of impressive. The thing about Laurinaitis is he's been portrayed for so long as a goofball that it's easy to forget that he was a decent wrestler himself back in the day. And that's about the only good thing I could say about this. Having John Cena pin Brock Lesnar to set up a pay-per-view match with John Laurinaitis is a great example of what I call the one step forward, three steps back formula that WWE has used for years now. Having Laurinaitis in the ring for a match may have made sense with CM Punk, actually, which was another storyline they teased and never paid off. It looked like that was the direction we were going in. At some point, we were going to get a pay-per-view match with Punk and Laurinaitis, and we never got it. And instead, he's wrestling John Cena. Why he's wrestling John Cena and why we should care, I have no idea. One step forward, three steps back. Let's shift over to TNA for a second. Hulk Hogan had a chat with the New York Post this week, and wouldn't you know, he's teasing another big change coming to TNA. I've lost track of how many big changes he has promoted here. He told the Post that TNA is going to be making a major move. He said, you can have a wrestling idea, but you need to have these momentum-shifting moves. We have the Hulkamania movement, then it shifted to the beer-drinking Stone Cold era. We reinvented the business with me growing back the black beard and becoming the bad guy. What's the next level? I have this huge monster idea that I am going to throw out there that I really think is going to change the business. We're going to give more power to the fans, make them more involved and more important. I can't say much more, but I can say this. I'm either going to be really right on this one or really wrong. And if I'm wrong, you probably won't see me again because I will be hightailing it out of here. That's what Hulk Hogan told the New York Post. And according to, the first report I saw was on ProWrestling.net. Word going around the Impact tapings on Monday was that Hogan's supposedly game-changing idea is for fans to film the TNA wrestlers whenever they may encounter them in public. Kind of like a TMZ ambush type of deal, only with TNA guys. They will then be encouraged, the fans will, to send the footage to TNA for possible inclusion on the Impact Wrestling TV show. And supposedly this idea was going to be revealed in a promo. It never happened. So either they've come to their senses and it's not going to happen, or it's going to be saved for a different day. But suffice to say, according to the reports, there are many wrestlers who are not happy with this idea at all. And on the one hand, I guess Hogan's thought is that by engaging the audience directly and urging them to send their own footage to the company, they would be more apt to watch the TV show because they would want to see their stuff on TV. Of course, when you consider the number of TNA fans that are actually out there to begin with and how often those people would actually find themselves in the presence of a TNA star, you kind of negate the purpose. On the other hand, and this is why I would imagine you have some very upset wrestlers, do you really want to start telling the fans, hey, whenever you see one of our guys, be sure to shove a camera in their face so we can put it on TV? And if they tell you to scram, just tell them the Hulkster sent you, brother. If Hogan is true to his word, I guess we've seen the last of him in TNA. And he'll be hightailing it out of there, because this has got to be the goddamn stupidest idea I have heard since, well, probably since last Sunday when they had Cena pin Lesnar. But before that, it's got to be the goddamn stupidest idea I've heard in a long time. How many supposed big changes can Hulk Hogan and Dixie Carter and TNA tease? It is a running joke at this point. The man changes his underwear as often as he seemingly changes the face of the company. At least I hope he does. I have taken the time to scribble down a quick list of other things that Hulk Hogan changes as often as he has changed TNA. So indulge me here for a moment, if you will. Things that Hulk Hogan has changed as often as he has changed TNA. Number one, his bandana. Hogan has a lot of bandanas, a lot of different colors, so I'm sure he's changed his bandana quite often. Breakfast cereals. I myself have recently gone from Corn Pops to Golden Grahams. Lanes on the highway. I'm sure he changes quite often. The channel on his TV, like apparently everyone else has been doing of late with Impact. And that's it. That's my list. Not a very well thought out list. Just a couple of things I scribbled down there. I am open to other suggestions, so my list is incomplete. By all means, if you have other ideas of things that Hulk Hogan has changed as often as he has changed TNA, then post on Facebook and let me know. Speaking of the Hulkster, they teased another match between him and Ric Flair during the tapings this week. They apparently have a plan to do a match between Hogan and Flair at Bound for Glory. All I know is that they did the same match at Halloween Havoc in 1994, and Flair was forced into retirement after that match, if you can believe it. And it is now almost 20 years later, and we are still talking about Hogan versus Flair. But by God, go stalk Ric Flair outside the bar and get him on camera and send it to TNA. That's a game changer right there. This week's award for flexibility goes to Vince McMahon's old nemesis, Phil Mushnick of the New York Post. I say flexibility because Mushnick has the uncanny skill of being able to take his foot and shove it so far into his mouth. It's actually quite amazing, and he does this quite often. Phil Mushnick, for the benefit of those of you who don't know, has been a television writer at the New York Post for probably over 20 years now. He hates Vince McMahon. He has made Vince McMahon a target for most of those 20 years. It goes back to the days of the steroid trial in the early 90s. And actually, it's kind of funny because when I was younger, I recalled an episode of Superstars where Vince McMahon was in what used to be the old kind of control center, the event center, where Gene Okerlund would give his updates. And there was Vince. And Vince went on this what had to have been no less than 5, 6, 7 minutes of talking in very vague terms. He would never name Mushnick. I don't think he did. You can probably find it on YouTube. I think I may have linked to it once, actually, on my Facebook page. But he went on this rant about the good guys and the bad guys and people trying to take them down and say things that weren't true. And, you know, as a younger fan, I had absolutely no idea what this guy was talking about. I thought he was nuts. But what he was talking about, what he actually went on a rant on his own show, on Superstars, was about Phil Mushnick. Phil Mushnick was the person he was referring to. And I will say this, the thing about Mushnick, and I'll get to why I'm even bringing him up in just a second, because it really doesn't have anything to do with wrestling, other than the connection with Vince. Phil Mushnick makes some salient points. Phil Mushnick has had an issue with Vince McMahon for years because of the way he treats his talent, because of the rampant use of drugs and steroids back in the day, and of course, as wrestlers over the years have dropped dead from those lifestyles and those choices they made, he has laid a lot of that blame at the foot of Vince McMahon. He thinks that Vince McMahon is indeed the devil incarnate, and there is no love lost between both men. The problem with Mushnick, even though he makes some salient points over the years, is that he has gone so far over the top with his hatred for Vince McMahon that you can't take anything he says seriously anymore. Not a goddamn thing. He has no credibility. He's just a cranky old man who rants about anything and everything. And that was never more apparent than this week. He did an article. And in his articles, he covers a couple of different things. So he'll cover a main topic, and then there'll be kind of a subhead. He'll cover something else, and then there'll be an item on something else. So he can talk about multiple things in the course of one column. And for the benefit of those of you who don't know, if you're not a basketball fan, the New Jersey Nets are no more. They are now not the New York Nets. They're the Brooklyn Nets. They have moved to Brooklyn, and it's kind of a big deal around here, and people are getting excited about it. Jay-Z is part owner of the team. Jay-Z, of course, we all know who Jay-Z is. At least I hope you do. And Jay-Z is known for having lyrics in his songs that perhaps might rub people the wrong way. He uses a lot of, you know, vernacular that, quite frankly, you find in a lot of rap music. It's just how it is. And Phil Mushnick does not like this. Phil Mushnick obviously does not think very highly of Jay-Z. And he had a quote in his column. This is what he said. He said, "Why the Brooklyn Nets? You know, basically, why call the team the Brooklyn Nets when you can call them the New York..." And then he used the N-word. Now, he didn't actually spell it out. It is censored in the newspaper. But basically, he used the N-word. And when I saw this, I had to do a double take, because even I didn't think that Phil Mushnick was dumb enough to actually say this in a newspaper article. But there it was, him advocating that instead of calling the Brooklyn Nets the Brooklyn Nets, they should be called the New York blank. He said the cheerleaders could be the Brooklyn bitches or hoes. Team logo, a 9mm with hollow tip shell casings strewn beneath. That's what Phil Mushnick said in his latest column. Obviously, this has caused quite an uproar here in New York, and I think elsewhere as well. If you Google the name Phil Mushnick under Google News, you'll get a lot of different items about it. A lot of people very upset. A lot of people calling for him to apologize, which he has since come out with a statement that was anything but apologetic. He refuses to apologize for his comments. And I myself am somebody who am not really big on political correctness, and everybody always has to apologize for everything, but I don't like Phil Mushnick. And so I do think it's appropriate in this case for him to apologize, because he didn't have to go that far in his column. He didn't have to use that word. That's a no-no. He just has some very awful ways of trying to prove what can sometimes be very valid points. You could even make the argument in this case that it's kind of hypocritical for Jay-Z to use lyrics like that in his music and then turn around and, you know, try to be some, big hero of the community and talk about the things he talks about. But all of that is completely lost when you make a stupid, dumbass remark like Mushnick did in the Post. So I just wanted to bring that up here and give him the distinction of, again, the foot-in-mouth award for this week. Because Phil Mushnick has proven time and time again He is a hate-filled, vile old man who obviously has issues and needs to seek help for those issues. He has made Vince McMahon a target of his. He has made wrestling a target of his. He does not care for pro wrestling. He thinks pro wrestling fans obviously are knuckle-draggers. And he goes ahead in his column this week and makes a comment like that. So now the entire world, not just wrestling fans, but the entire world can know what a gigantic douchebag Phil Mushnick of the New York Post is. Couldn't happen to a nicer guy. If there's anything that was going to happen that could potentially result in this guy losing his job, maybe it'll be this. Maybe it'll be this. Maybe if enough people complain to the Post, they will actually do something about it. I doubt it, but you never know. Before I get to the shout-outs and questions for this week, I did mention last week that we were celebrating a very special anniversary this weekend. It was 10 years ago this weekend that the World Wrestling Federation went away and officially became World Wrestling Entertainment. And I just wanted to set aside a few moments here just to talk about that and how different the company is now than it was in 2002 when that change was made. Now, I get questions quite often from you guys about that whole situation with changing the initials and why did they do it and what was the events that kind of led to the name change. Was it something they voluntarily did? So, just to give you a little bit of background here, in October of 2001, a UK court, might have been the High Court in the UK, ruled that the World Wrestling Federation had breached an agreement that was signed in 1994 with the World Wildlife Fund for the use of its logo and the WWF.com web domain. The fund argued that WWF's association at that time, in the late 90s, with violence and sleaze, was damaging to them by association, and the fund's ability to raise money for nature conservation was also harmed by WWF, that being the wrestling company's horrible reputation at that time. So, in February of 2002, the English Court of Appeal upheld the High Court's order that the World Wildlife Fund was entitled to the exclusive use of the initials WWF anywhere outside the United States. This is an important point because if they wanted to, WWF could have continued using the name World Wrestling Federation and the WWF initials in this country and just used a different name elsewhere. But obviously that would not have made any sense at all. In fact, I just don't see how that would have been possible, realistically speaking. So WWF initially said, that being the wrestling company, said that they would appeal the decision to the House of Lords, and then they decided not to appeal after all. So in theory, they could have appealed the decision and had the decision reversed. No way of knowing for sure if that would have happened, but in theory, they could have appealed. It could have potentially been reversed, and they just opted not to do so. They did not want to appeal. So following the case, the use of the Attitude Era logo, the Scratch logo, became prohibited. That's why when you watch footage and all the WWE DVDs and the footage on television from the Attitude Era, you see those blurs all over the place because that logo, it was requested, should be blurred. And past references to the WWF initials also would need to be censored. However, WWE is permitted use of the original WWF block letter logo from the 80s. Basically, the logo they used from the 80s straight through until 98 when they switched to the Scratch logo. They had that new generation logo, which was the WWF logo in the box and all that. All that is fair game. They could still use that. They may also use the full World Wrestling Federation name as it sees fit. So that's why in that same footage where WWF is kind of censored, and the Attitude logo is blocked out, they can still speak the words World Wrestling Federation because there is no confusion about that. When you say World Wrestling Federation, it's obvious what you're referring to. They don't have a problem with that. What they feel is that when you use the initials WWF, that's where the supposed confusion comes into play. So that is why any references to World Wrestling Federation in classic footage is not censored. So anyway, that's the quick backstory there about the situation between the two sides. From all accounts, Vince McMahon did violate the agreement that they had signed. He did. At least that was the belief anyway. And so in a lot of ways, they really don't have anybody to blame but themselves. Vince McMahon, Linda McMahon, they did claim later on that the Wildlife Fund tried to extort them out of $90 million. and they refused. I don't know if that's true or not. It could very well be. Maybe there was... I'm sure both sides are not completely innocent. We know WWF is not innocent. As far as the wildlife people over there, who knows? You know, the panda people. But that was the deal with the whole situation there. So, it was in May, I believe May 5th, 2002, that the change became official. We saw those commercials, Get the F Out, which was kind of creative. And here we are today now, 10 years later. And to this day, I will still sometimes refer to it as WWF. I was one of those people after it happened. I said, there's no way I'm ever going to call it WWE. That sounds ridiculous. And it still kind of sounds ridiculous, to be honest with you. But I've obviously gotten used to it. But I'll still slip a WWF reference in there quite often because that's what I grew up on. You know, I grew up on it being the WWF. WWF rolls off the tongue a lot better than WWE. So, you know, that's kind of how it goes. May of 2002 was interesting because I always thought it's quite apropos that the final WWF champion in the record books, the man who will go down as the last reigning WWF champion, was Hulk Hogan. Hogan had beaten Triple H the month before at Backlash to win the Undisputed title, his sixth and final WWF championship. And he didn't lose it to The Undertaker until the next pay-per-view towards the end of May. This change took place early in May, and so technically Hogan was the last reigning WWF champion. There's just something about that to me that seems rather appropriate. It almost seems right that he would be the last reigning WWF champion. And, of course, as I said, he lost the title. It was also around that time period that Brock Lesnar arrived on television. He debuted the night after WrestleMania in March. So he had already been on television for about a month and a half before this change took place. But to me, when Brock won the championship a couple months later, and then eventually also became a babyface not long after that, Brock Lesnar's arrival as a big-time player in WWE really signaled a shift in the product. Because in the late 90s into the early 2000s, it was the Attitude Era. It was WWF against WCW. Then it was the Invasion, right? And you had some of these old WCW guys coming in, like Bischoff and the NWO and all that. And WWF did have Kurt Angle for a number of years. Kurt Angle, a legitimate athlete, Olympic gold medalist and all that. But when Lesnar became big, Lesnar became part of something in late 02 into 03 called the SmackDown Six. I believe the SmackDown Six comprised of Lesnar, Angle, Eddie, Chavo, Ray, and Benoit. I believe that was the SmackDown Six. It was this core group of guys on the SmackDown brand that it wasn't so much about the ridiculous over-the-top angles and gimmicks. It was about guys with real talent who can go in there and put on great matches. And I believe that was around the same period that Paul Heyman was writing or booking the SmackDown brand. Surprise, surprise. SmackDown became the A-show. I would not miss an episode of SmackDown, whereas Raw, which I would watch, was insufferable. Raw during, and I'll get into why in a second. A lot of that has to do with Triple H. But SmackDown became the A show. I would not miss a show. Whereas now, I just don't care. But and it was unique also in that, you know, the brand split occurred. The first brand split occurred right around that same time period. I think it was in the summer of 02. Spring or summer of 02. Either way. But there was a definite shift in the type of product that WWE, at least on SmackDown, was putting out. You had guys like Lesnar and Shelton Benjamin and Charlie Haas, you know, guys that were high school and college athletes who could really go. It wasn't about gimmicks, it wasn't about characters so much as it was about these amateur wrestlers and athletes and guys that can go in there and have kick-ass matches. And that was something that really was never a priority in WWF. In years past, it was about star power. It was about characters. It was about gimmicks. The Attitude Era is not chock full of great wrestling matches. The Attitude Era was chock full of guys who were just really over and really popular. The Mankind character and Mr. Socko, The Rock being the corporate champion, Stone Cold, of course, being the top guy, the Ministry Undertaker and all that. You don't find too many great wrestling matches, you know, during that time period in WWF. You really don't. So I think, not that the name change had anything to do with it. My point in all this is not saying that because the name changed, all these things happened. But it's just interesting to see that when the name change did take place, there just so happened to be at that time, not long after, a definitely noticeable shift in the WWE product. That kind of coincided with that. And another thing also that happened later in that year was what I like to call the beginning of Triple H's reign of terror. Triple H was literally handed the World Heavyweight Championship by Eric Bischoff in a briefcase on Raw 1 week. There was no tournament, there was no competition or anything to crown a new champion. They did the brand split. They needed a champion on the Raw brand. And so they literally decided, we're just going to hand Triple H the belt. Why? Especially since he lost to Shawn Michaels at SummerSlam? I have no idea. I guess Eric Bischoff was the heel GM, and so that's what a heel GM does. So Triple H had the championship, and he proceeded to wipe out nearly everybody on the brand. He did kind of, he did give his best friend Shawn Michaels a nice little hat tip, gave him a one-month reign with the championship, beat him the next month, got the belt back, and Triple H went on to beat a lot of guys. He beat a lot of guys. First guy he really beat was Rob Van Dam, who supposedly was supposed to win the championship in their first match that same month that Triple H was handed the championship at Unforgiven on pay-per-view. RVD and Triple H had a match. And as the story goes, RVD was at one point scheduled to win the championship. Triple H talked people out of it. He didn't feel Van Dam was ready, or he thought he was too small, or whatever the case may be. And of course, it was rebooked, and Triple H beat him. And we all know what happened to Rob Van Dam at that point. At the Survivor Series, he also crushed Triple H's larynx, coming off the top of one of the Elimination Chamber pods for a frog splash. And the very next month, Rob Van Dam was on pay-per-view, not wrestling, but he was via satellite at the WWF restaurant having hamburgers. And Triple H went on to beat Kane, beat Booker T. Now, the thing about Kane is, you know, Triple H beating Kane is fine. It's, you know, it's not like, oh my God, he beat Kane and this young up-and-comer. Kane was already an established guy at that point. God, excuse me. And Triple H beat him. He unified the world in Intercontinental Championships. So there was a period of about 7 months or so where there was no Intercontinental title. They did away with it before deciding to bring it back in, I believe, May of the following year. So Triple H, in short order, disposed of RVD. He disposed of Kane. And then he got into a feud in early 03 with Booker T, who was pretty over with the crowd, and they had a world championship match at WrestleMania. Now, if you're going to book Triple H to beat Booker T, fine. If that's what you want to do, then fine. I think what really aggravated me, and even to this day, just makes me shake my head, is the way that Triple H beat Booker T at WrestleMania. Triple H had some momentum, or rather Booker T, I should say, had some momentum at the time, went into the match a big babyface, opposing the big heel champion, Triple H. Back then, Triple H, in a lot of his main event matches against Shawn Michaels and guys like that, would, you know, hit his finisher, the pedigree, and people would kick out. Maybe the second pedigree would put him away or something like that. Well, not in this match, not at WrestleMania, against Booker T. Triple H hit Booker T in this match with a pedigree, and both guys were down. And so much time elapsed between the time that Triple H hit this one pedigree and the time that he ultimately pinned Booker T, I could have gotten in the DeLorean, flown back to 1985, tried to save the world, flew back to 1955, flew back to 2003, and Triple H still would have been crawling towards Booker T to make the cover. It was an eternity that passed between the time he hit the move, and then he covered him, and he pinned him. There was no near fall. There was no follow-up pedigree. He just beat Booker T like nothing. And that was the end of Booker T at that point. I think 2 months later, Booker T was feuding with Christian for the Intercontinental title. Goldberg came to WWE around this time. And they had the Elimination Chamber match at SummerSlam that year. Remember, Triple H was nursing a groin injury. This was the period where Triple H was wearing those ridiculous-looking biker shorts. It was so tight. He just looked completely ridiculous. Obviously, these biker shorts were so tight, I guess, because the tighter it is, the less pain he would have felt. His work suffered at this point because he was hurt. But here's the Elimination Chamber match. Here's WWE's big opportunity to make Bill Goldberg look like the monster that he should be. And he did. He looked like a monster in this match, and the people were really into him. And then Triple H hit him with a sledgehammer and pinned him. And the next month, he had a long match with Goldberg that was not particularly good, and finally Goldberg won the championship. But by that point, the bloom was off the rose. It's kind of like the Brock Lesnar thing. sometimes it only takes one match. You only have one chance sometimes to make a really good first impression on people. And that night at SummerSlam, Goldberg had the real chance to get over as something special and really dominate and win the championship, and Triple H just beat him. Just beat him. So this went into he beat a couple of other people too. He beat Kevin Nash. He had a feud with his good buddy Kevin Nash, and they had a couple of matches on pay-per-view. And anyway, the point is, I personally don't look back fondly on this Triple H Reign of Terror. I know some people do. Some people liked it. And look, here's the comparison that I would make. I like a dominant heel champion as much as the next guy. And the holy grail to point to, at least in terms of the modern generation, I can't speak to, you know, I'm sure superstar Billy Graham was a great heel champion back in his day, although he only held the belt for like 9 or 10 months, which, especially back then, was like nothing. But you look to Ric Flair. Ric Flair in the mid to late 80s was a great heel champion, who was actually liked by a lot of people as well, but he was a heel. Ric Flair could go in there and have a great match with almost anybody. And Ric Flair, I don't want to call Ric Flair the greatest technical wrestler of all time, because I don't think that would be true. In fact, Ric Flair's matches, for the most part, were very formulaic. It was the same stuff over and over again. But Flair was so good in trying to get guys over, whether he would beat them or lose to them. That was his modus operandi. He would always try to put the other guy over and make them look good. He had great matches with everybody from Dusty Rhodes to Terry Funk, Barry Windham, Sting, Lex Luger, Ricky Steamboat, all those guys, Vader. That's what Ric Flair was known for. Triple H modeled himself after Ric Flair. He idolized Ric Flair as a fan growing up. If you take a look at George Napolitano's book, and I interviewed him about it when we spoke on Sound Off 182, he came out with a wrestling photo book last year called High Spots and Hot Shots. Hot Shots and High Spots, I'm sorry. Which is a great book, by the way. And there are photos in the book that he himself took in the early 90s, around 93, when Triple H was first breaking into the business with Killer Kowalski. He was at a gym somewhere. And you just look at Triple H back then, and with the robe and everything, the way he was dressed, the golden platinum blonde hair, it was obvious who Triple H modeled himself after when he came into the business. And obviously now they're very good friends. Flair went on to manage Triple H. They were part of Evolution together. But the point is, when you look at Triple H during this Reign of Terror, what irked me more than anything else, how many guys did Triple H really go out of his way to make look good, even in defeat, even if he was going to beat them, so that he can go on to have a nice long reign as a dominant heel champion? How many guys did Triple H actually help get over? He basically squashed Rob Van Dam. He disposed of Kane. He squashed Booker T. You could find countless examples of this. Every now and then he would have a nice match on Raw. You know, he had a great match years earlier on Raw with Taka Michinoku. I thought he was great during that initial WWF title run in 2000. But for some reason, that reign from 02 to 04 is just, to me, a very dark period in Raw history. And when I think back to the name change in 02, even though Triple H didn't get the belt until many months later, I associate that Triple H Reign of Terror with the start of WWE, which maybe is why I don't look back too fondly on that period. I really don't. I mean, he put Benoit over in 2004 at WrestleMania. That was a great moment. Maybe not in retrospect. It's kind of depressing, actually, to look back at that final scene at WrestleMania 20 with Benoit and Eddie. But Benoit won the championship, held it for a couple months, lost it to Randy Orton at SummerSlam, and then Orton got crushed by Triple H the very next month. Orton's momentum at that time and potential to get over as a babyface the first time around was completely derailed when Triple H beat him. Now, in fairness, in 05, Triple H put over Batista like $1 million. He made Batista a star. WrestleMania 21 did over 1 million pay-per-view buys, largely on the back of that main event. Kurt Angle and Shawn Michaels was a dream match to a lot of wrestling fans, but that doesn't equal 1 million buys. And there weren't any celebrities on that show either. The closest thing to a celebrity on that show was David Arquette, sitting in the front row as a fan. Triple H and Batista did big business. He put Batista over at WrestleMania. In fact, Batista beat him in 3 straight pay-per-view matches that year. And that was largely because, you know, Batista was one of those guys that Triple H had handpicked to be part of Evolution, who eventually got over, and he was more than happy to put the big jacked-up Dave Batista over like he did in 05. But look at that period from the end of 02, more so 03. That was really the year, as a fan, watching Raw was just so difficult, because it was just the same shtick all the time. You know, he would have these matches. He would always win. He wouldn't help put guys over. He would come out every week. Raw would start. It became a running joke. Oh, here we go. You know, the Raw's going to start with a 20-minute-long Triple H promo. And it was the same shit all the time. It got old. It got old very quickly. So, anyway, I personally associate that reign with the beginning of the so-called WWE era. I'm happy to say that things have gotten better over time. But personally, I look back on those days and think about that. And, I mean, there's other things also that you can point to as far as there were far fewer fans. There are far fewer fans now than there were back in 2002. Particularly WCW fans that have long since abandoned wrestling, though that was likely going to happen anyway. In fact, once WCW got gobbled up by WWF, it didn't take very long for those old WCW fans to go away. But back then, there were so many more fans in 02 than there are today. It's just incredible. One of the biggest changes, probably from then to now, was the implementation of a wellness policy in 2005, which they instituted after the death of Eddie Guerrero. Back in 02, there was no drug policy in WWE. There was none. There had been periods before. The first drug policy I think the company ever instituted was in 87. And that was more so, not even really so much to crack down on steroids or performance enhancers, so to speak. That was because WWF had a big cocaine problem at that time, and it was more PR than anything else. Let's try to crack down on this. When the steroid trial happened and Vince, you know, was in a lot of hot water, actually before the steroid trial in 94, probably around 92, they instituted what, up until the current wellness policy, was probably the most serious drug policy that Vince McMahon had ever implemented. They fired the British Bulldog. They fired the Ultimate Warrior, I believe, who, two of their biggest baby faces, and the Warrior was probably the biggest star they had since Hogan was not around at that point. And they fired them because I believe they suspected they were importing growth hormone from overseas. So you go back and look at that period, you can even tell by the physiques of certain people relative to the early 90s or the late 80s. You could definitely see a change from about 92 to 95 in WWF. Vince was serious. Granted, you had Lex Luger and even Davey Boy Smith, who they eventually brought back, who you look at and you go, there's no way these guys are clean. There's just no way. And I believe Lex Luger has a book coming out, and in the book he's actually going to talk about how he was able to circumvent the drug policy, because he admits he was still on shit during that period when other people were not. And I guess he found certain ways to get around that, and I think in this book he's working on, he actually reveals the methods that he used to get around it. But that was a very clean period for the WWF, and then we all know what happened. The Monday Night Wars began, and WWF began losing to WCW. WCW was raiding their talent. They brought in Hogan and Savage and Piper and all these guys over, and there was no drug policy in WCW at the time. If there was, it was a joke. And so those guys can run rampant and do whatever they want to, and surprisingly, people like Hulk Hogan started to get all buffed up again. And Vince McMahon's logic was, we can't compete against that. It's unfair that we have a policy in place and we're trying to restrict it. They're taking all of our talent and they're running roughshod, and they could do whatever they want, and their guys look like $1 million. So it was at that point, around 96, 97, that the WWF drug policy went away, quietly went away. And all bets were off at that point. And again, it wasn't until 05, when Eddie died, that they instituted the wellness policy, which I'm sure that even today there are probably so many loopholes in the policy, probably big enough to drive a truck through. I personally don't believe that people like The Rock or Undertaker are drug tested. Triple H, I don't believe, is drug tested either, because his loophole is that he is also an executive in the company, and executives in the company do not have to be drug tested. So therefore, Triple H is an executive. Even when he wrestles, he does not have to be tested. I don't think that's fair, but that's just how it is. But even so, the current policy they have is obviously the strongest that it's ever been. And that's one of the biggest differences between the company then and now. The company obviously is still doing very well. They have a lot more in terms of revenue streams than they did back then. They have a movie studio. They're going to be launching a network. So it's very interesting to look back on 2002 WWF and how things are today in 2012. Is the company better off now than it was then? In some ways, yes. In other ways, no. They chased off so many fans over the years that I don't know they'll ever be able to get those people back. The product now is also very different than it was back then, because, you know, back then it felt like more of a wrestling company. And I think to some degree now it's so much the scripting of everything and you know, focusing on the entertainment aspect of it. It almost feels like a departure from, you know, wrestling as it was back then. And that's not always a good thing. There's some good stuff now, there's some bad stuff. But definitely the company has changed since then. And it's hard for me to fathom that a lot of people, some people who even listen to this podcast are young enough where they didn't even know WWF. I mean, they grew up solely on WWE. They know nothing of this, you know, WWF old company from back in the day. It kind of makes me feel older than I really am. But there you go. It was 10 years ago that the transformation took place, and it's a very different world now than it was back then. Let's do some shout-outs. If you have shout-outs to send in, you can email me at thesolemonster@gmail.com. First thing I want to mention is Adam Foster. If you are listening, your email account appears to have been hacked, so you might want to look into that. Emin Rogers writes in, "Hey, Solemonster, listener from around episode 45, wondering if I could get a good luck shout-out as I will be making my debut as a professional wrestler May 6th for my local independent company Pro Wrestling Ulster at an event entitled Proving Grounds. I will be going up against former PWU Tag Team Champion Hollywood Sanchez in his first match after betraying his longtime tag team partner at the last pay-per-view. We'll give it my best shot, and hopefully you'll be talking about me and how watered down WWE has made me and how they're not using me right in years to come." So, good luck, Emin. I would love nothing more than to talk about how WWE or TNA is misusing you in the future, and maybe we could even do an interview on the show once you become all big and special. Tyler Sands writes in, "Solemonster, I'm a huge fan of the show. Been listening since episode 100. My birthday is on Sunday, May 6th, and I was wondering if I could get a shout-out. Hopefully I am ever so closer to seeing my favorite wrestler, Dolph Ziggler, actually win a WWE title match. I would not hold my breath on that, Tyler, because if you do, you may not make it to your next birthday. But for now, happy birthday." Troy also writes in, this is the last shout-out here, "I have been listening to the Sound Off since episode 156, so I am obviously a big fan of the show. Was wondering if I could get a shout-out. After a long and tough journey, I have finally graduated from Arizona State University. Even though I am going to start my career and make that money, money, yeah, yeah, I will always make time for the Sound Off." Smart man. Hopefully when you start making that money, money, you can send some of that over to me. So congratulations, Troy. And again, if you have shout-outs of your own, you can email me at thesolemonster@gmail.com. That is also the place to send in your mailbag questions. Let's answer a couple here. This first one comes from Sky. "I got my girlfriend to sit down and watch some WWE with me. She's from Indonesia, and she was very young during the Attitude Era, but remembers watching it. We watched Punk vs. Jericho from Extreme Rules, and her first words were, 'What are they wearing? Are those jeans?' Laughed pretty hard at that. Then we watched Lesnar vs. Cena, and she actually liked the match, popped for a lot of the dramatic spots. I put on Raw, and aside from Triple H getting his arm broken, she buried the show. As soon as Jack Swagger came on screen, she instantly said, 'This is stupid,' and lost all interest." Well, me too. "In an attempt to make up for the horrible show that was Raw, I put on WrestleMania, and we watched Undertaker and Triple H. She loved it. Any of your girlfriends ever watch or like wrestling?" Well, actually, one girl that I dated, I think I mentioned it on the show, it was actually the same girl when I shared the Dolph Ziggler printer story on one of the episodes. I forget which number. But we would watch AM Raw. A lot of times we would be hanging out and in the basement, and then it would be 2 o'clock in the morning, and all of a sudden AM Raw would come on for an hour with highlights from the show on Monday night, and she would actually enjoy it. You know, she wouldn't complain or anything like that. She would watch it and ask questions about the characters, and of course John Cena was a favorite, which is why we don't date anymore. It's a hard thing to actually find a girl who is that into wrestling as much as you are. I think you could, certainly, but I think it's very difficult to just randomly find somebody who happens to share the same love of pro wrestling that you do. It's not like baseball or, you know, football. Some girls are sports fans, some girls are not. But it's a lot easier, I would think, to find a girl who is a sports fan. So if you happen to find somebody who's a wrestling fan and shares that same interest, I say good for you. Or in this case, if you know you have somebody who is not necessarily a wrestling fan but can enjoy it, it certainly makes for a fun time when you sit down and watch a show, and especially when she tends to agree with your own opinions on what's good and what sucks. I find it kind of funny, actually, that she had that reaction to Jack Swagger, because I mentioned earlier in my Raw review, it's a shame I don't know. The guy had something at one point, and now he doesn't. They've beaten it out of him. And it's a shame because he's actually a really good talent, and I think he could potentially be something big. How you rehab him at this point, it's hard. It really is hard to think about how you rehab somebody like Jack Swagger, who has been at a certain level now for so long that people just don't look at him beyond that level. Keelan writes in, says he's a longtime listener. This is the first time I've gotten in contact. Been following SC Scoop since the summer of 05 and been listening to the Sound Off all the way since episode 1. Like yourself, I can't believe it's been 5 years. In episode 216, you said how you consider the Undertaker Dead Man gimmick to be the best that wrestling has ever seen. Actually, I think I was talking more WWE, but you could be right. He says, I think a strong argument can be made for the Tiger Mask gimmick being the greatest ever. Originally conceived as a way to bring more children to the New Japan product due to its origins as an anime character, an idea that sounds cheesy on paper, it got over with kids and adults alike due to the talent of the first Tiger Mask, Satoru Sayama. He says, if I were a member of the WWE, TNA, or Ring of Honor booking team, and we're given the task of attracting more children to the product, how would you do so in a way that does not compromise business, damage the product, or drive the ticket-buying adult fan away? Honestly, make more babyface characters with masks. Look how well Rey Mysterio has done. Look how well Sin Cara has done in a very limited period of time in WWE through both a suspension and an injury. These guys were selling merchandise like hotcakes, including those masks. You take a masked babyface character, that is probably the easiest way to get over with the kids' audience. And possibly even bring more kids in. Because the last thing you want, you don't want another John Cena. You know, even maybe for business you want another John Cena, but as a fan, I certainly would not want another John Cena. Now your question is, if I were a member of the booking team, then yes. I mean, it's nice to have a character like a John Cena who sells a lot of merchandise, who's, you know, got some great lessons for kids about never giving up and rising above hate and all that kind of stuff. But to me, the easiest way to do it, if you want to sell merchandise and rope those kids in, is bring in a character that, or bring in somebody perhaps who doesn't have a mask and put a mask on them. They'd have to be a baby face and not a heel. That's probably the easiest way to do it. You mentioned Tiger Mask. Tiger Mask obviously had a mask. There's something about the mask that kids love. And so if you want a really simple way to do it, that would be the way to do it. Steven from Leicester, England writes in, after watching Bray Wyatt's debut match and his two promos in FCW, I watched some of the Waylon Mercy promos from years ago and some of his matches and got thinking, what would you think after Bray debuts, hopefully with this gimmick on WWE television, what would you think if they brought back Waylon Mercy, say after about 6 months of being on TV as a long-lost relative of Bray Wyatt, but not bringing him back for a long tenure, say maybe about a month or two? Would that be a bad idea? I don't think it would be a bad idea. It could be an interesting thing to see if done well. Bray Wyatt is so good at what he's been doing, and Waylon Mercy was also really good in his gimmick. I don't think it would be a bad idea. I think it would be a bad idea. And I think it would be a bad idea just because Dandy Spivey, I haven't seen Spivey in years. Physically, I know he was not doing too well. He certainly doesn't look the way that he used to look. The Waylon Mercy character partially worked because of the look, the hair. I mean, his outfit was obviously very basic. It was like a white tank top with white pants. But I don't think he has the long hair anymore. He looks a lot older. Again, physically, I don't know what condition he's in. I don't know where he is these days. That character also, the problem with that character back then, it had a lot of potential. I don't agree when people lump in the Waylon Mercy character with, you know, all the other crappy wrestling gimmicks from over the years. There have been a lot of crappy wrestling gimmicks. The Waylon Mercy character could have gone, how far I don't know, but it could have gone further. His career came to an end due to an injury. That's what happened. He wasn't around long enough where hardly anybody these days is a wrestling fan, aside maybe from you and me, is going to know who the guy is. It's not even kind of a big mid-card name from the past. He would show up on TV and nobody would know who he is. And so I don't know what the value is in bringing him in. You're saying bring him in for a month or two. All right, so you might pop some of the, you know, internet wrestling fans who were around in 1995 to see the character for a couple of months. But beyond that, what are you really getting out of it? You know, Spivey has basically removed himself from the wrestling business. Like I said, he doesn't look like he used to look. I don't know what physical condition he is even in these days. I just don't see what the the upswing is for Bray Wyatt. You know, what good does it do him to bring in somebody as a long-lost relative if they're only going to stick around for 4 to 6 weeks? You know, if it was somebody with a name, maybe I would say, okay, it's worth it. Maybe this person can give him the rub, but I just don't see what benefit it would give him at all. Patrick Phillips writes into the Sound Off. Love the show. I've been a listener since the summer of 2010. I have a business question for you. I've noticed that the detailed business articles about the stock, corporate hirings, and such on SCScoops.com pertaining to WWE are some of the least popular and least discussed on the entire website. Why do you think that wrestling fans are disinterested in the finer details of the corporate end of a major wrestling company? Maybe it's just the Harvidian in me. Yes, I own the exact same tie as David Otunga. Or maybe it's the businessman in me. I did pretty good with WWE shares when they hit their 52-week low and bounced back after the first quarter earnings were announced. But I just think that wrestling fans would be interested in the prosperity of the company. Well, here's the thing. When people go to a website like an SCScoops, they may care about ratings. They may care about pay-per-view buys because they've been trained and conditioned to think that those things matter. When it comes to the stock price, which fluctuates every day, and there really is no rhyme or reason. I mean, coming off WrestleMania, you know, probably the biggest buy rate they've ever done, if the numbers pan out, I think the stock went down. So when it comes to the stock, when it comes to, you know, they have these shareholder meetings, and I think people look for the real meat and potatoes in them. They don't care how WWE did in a quarter, for example, with its home video business, or how the movie studio did. They want to know what, you know, the buy rates were. They want to know what's going on with the network. Are they going to put Macho Man in the Hall of Fame? I get questions all the time, you know, when they schedule stockholder meetings and people say, well, you know, somebody should ask about putting Savage in the Hall of Fame, and it's not business questions. So the mentality is just different. I don't think people go to websites like SCScoops for business news. I think they want gossip. They want to know what's going on behind the scenes. They want to know why this guy didn't go over in this feud and all that type of stuff. And unless, like you, they have a background of some sort in business and they already have an interest in that subject, I think that's the reason they look at numbers and they think this is boring. What do I care? You know, why am I going to read the latest earnings report for this company? It's just not the sort of thing they care about. Not to say they don't care about the prosperity of the company, but people, you know, they just don't follow the business end of it. Let's say like somebody like you or me, and I'm not a business major. I didn't, you know, graduate as a business major in college or anything like that. But I certainly have an interest in knowing about these things, and I talk about it here on the podcast, and a lot of times it's stuff that people don't even know because they don't bother reading into it. It's just not everybody is predisposed to having an interest in business and numbers and financial stuff, and I would say that by and large, the people that visit a lot of the wrestling websites like SCScoops just don't have an interest in it, but they don't necessarily not care about whether or not the company is doing well or not. I just think they look at things a little bit differently. Their priorities are a little bit different. Their interests are obviously very different. And it's up to people like you and me, I guess, to pay attention to stuff like that. But anyway, that comes from Patrick, who I think that might have been the first time actually he's written into the show. This question comes from Sean, who writes in, been a loyal listener since episode 188, said that he loves the show. His question is there legit heat between The Rock and Shawn Michaels? How come they never worked a program together in the WWF days? A lot of that has to do with the fact their paths just barely crossed. You know, I think Michaels got hurt in early 98 and was out of action for 4.5 years. And 98 is the year where The Rock really first started getting into coming into his own. He didn't win his first world championship and really become a main event player until the fall of 1998, by which point Michaels had already been out of action for many months. So their paths just narrowly came close to crossing, but not quite. The only time I think they ever really had any direct working relationship was when they appeared together as part of the corporation, which also was pretty short-lived. The thing with Rock is he did have heat with Michaels in that. The story is that when Rock was very young, Michaels and Marty Jannetty as the Rockers would come to Hawaii to work for his family, who was promoting wrestling at that time. And I think Rock's impression of Michaels from back in those days and maybe the way he conducted himself was not very positive. That coupled with the fact that Rock was more of a Bret Hart ally in WWF. You know, if you had to pick sides, Rock was more of a Bret Hart guy than a Shawn Michaels guy. Bret really helped take Rock under his wing in 97 for a period of time. He helped put him over even, I think, in a match on Raw once. He made The Rock look good and gave him advice. I don't know if he actually helped train him at all, but there was a relationship there, and I'm sure at that time, with all the animosity between Bret Hart and Shawn Michaels and then what happened in Montreal and the perception of Michaels as being this backstabbing bastard, Rock just had no interest in working with Shawn Michaels. Even when Michaels came back in 02, it was not something that Rock pitched. Because I'm sure if Vince McMahon had been pitched the idea of Michaels and Rock, that would have been kind of a dream match to promote for a WrestleMania. And we never got it. And a lot of that had to do more so with Rock than Michaels. But in recent years, it seems like Rock's attitude towards him has softened quite a bit. I think when he inducted his father and grandfather into the Hall of Fame back in 08, Rock made some comments to the effect of having wished he had been able to work with some guys, and I think Michaels was one of those guys that he named. So that really was the reason that they never worked together. The big reason, though, was just the fact that Michaels got hurt. Because if Michaels didn't get hurt, even if Rock maybe wasn't all that enthusiastic back then about working with him, their paths would have crossed at some point. They would have had to have done Michaels and Rock at some point in 99 or in 2000 or 2001. But Michaels was gone. So that really is the biggest reason why that match never happened. Valentino from Scotland writes in, "Dear Solo Monster, can I please have a shout-out for everyone in the Sound Off Facebook group? For someone my age, there is not many people that I can talk wrestling with, and those who I can think Triple H is the real chairman of WWE. Kane and Mask Kane are two different people, and TNA is about to overcome WWE. Through all the annoying BS, there is some lively and heated debates, which are awesome. Some of the pictures and posts can be quite hilarious, and it's just really cool to have that amount of people to be able to talk about wrestling." Well, you picked the wrong week to ask me to give a shout-out to the Facebook group. I'm going to reject your request for a shout-out. Not too enthusiastic about that group this week, but anyway. His question here is, when you announced on the bicentennial edition of the Sound Off that you were going to WrestleMania, you said you were going with Noah and Webmaster Mike. Whatever happened to plans? Plans didn't change too much. I mean, I got to hang out with all three of them. I just ended up spending more of my time with Noah and Brian than I did with Webmaster Mike. But I did spend some time with Webmaster Mike at his palace, shall we say. This question comes from Adam. He was watching the CM Punk Chris Jericho street fight from Extreme Rules. He was wondering if there was any particular reason they were both wearing their wrestling boots. Normally, don't the participants just wear street shoes and not their wrestling gear? It looks a little funny to me. Actually, in most street fights I've seen in WWE, if they even bother to wear jeans, which doesn't always happen, I'm pretty sure they wear their wrestling boots. I'm just thinking back. I remember a boot camp match, which I guess that was sort of a street fight, with Triple H and Sergeant Slaughter from like 97. Pretty sure they wore wrestling boots. I'm sure in most street fights in WWE they've worn their boots. I don't really recall too many people wearing sneakers. So I think actually in WWE anyway, the opposite is true, but I'm sure if I'm wrong, somebody will let me know. Matthew Scala writes in, "Every time I get a question from Matthew and I see his last name, I think of Scally. I was a fan of Tony Scali from that old Commish TV show that used to be on ABC many years ago." Anyway, Baffy writes in. He had a couple of comments coming off Raw, one of which kind of irked me. He said he notices more and more each week that Eve's face looks exactly like China's. It's quite hilarious. No, it's not. First of all, have you seen what China's face looks like these days? I think SE Scoops had some pictures during the week of what China did to her face. To compare China's face or anything about China to Eve is such an insult to Eve, it's not even funny. I think Eve is actually a pretty girl. If you look at China, it's like something out of a House of Horrors. I certainly don't look at China and think of Eve. I don't know what you're looking at. But anyway, he said he enjoyed the podcast prior to Raw. Cool concept. Keep up the great work. So he salvaged himself with a compliment here at the end of his email. So that's from Matthew. Cody writes in, loyal listener since episode 197. Question is that on a December 1997 episode of Raw, where there is a naughty Santa who ends up getting stunned by Stone Cold, who plays this Santa? That was played by Steve Lombardi, also known as the Brooklyn Brawler, also known as Abe Knuckleball Schwartz, one of the one of those awful gimmicks I was talking about earlier from the mid-90s WWF when the baseball players went on strike. They had Lombardi paint his face like a baseball, and he would camp out in a crowd with picket signs because, you see, he was a baseball player on strike. Hardy har har. Last question comes from Kyle, dear Solomonster. After watching the April 30th edition of Raw, the only conclusion I can draw is that John Laurinaitis is a bigger threat to John Cena than Brock Lesnar. Has Vince lost his damn mind? How much money do you think Vince has pissed away here so he can soothe his own ego and make sure that no one is bigger than WWE? A lot of money is the only way I can answer that question. Vince has pissed quite a bit of money away on blown angles and people who probably should have and could have been a lot bigger than they were, especially guys he brought over from WCW, because, you know, you had that mentality that, well, they're a WCW guy. We've got to beat them and prove that we are, in fact, a superior brand and always have been. And what they did with Lesnar was kind of an example of the same thing. They're going to make a lot of money with Brock Lesnar, but they will not make the kind of money they could have before. That's just the way it goes. So that's the mailbag for this week. I'm going to cinch this bad boy up. You have questions, you know how to reach me. TheSolomonster@gmail.com. Never changes. It's always the same. Follow me on Twitter, @Solomonster. And you can friend me on Facebook. Facebook.com/TheSolomonster is the shortcut address. That will take you to the profile. You send me a friend request, and if I approve you, you can be part of our little community. Again, every Monday night during Raw, we have a live thread up, so you can follow the action and chat with your fellow fans and all that good stuff on Facebook. And sometimes I'll live blog on Twitter as well if I'm feeling froggy, so that's why you should follow me on there as well. And again, iTunes, easiest way to get the podcast is just to subscribe to it. You subscribe, every time a new episode goes up, it will automatically download for you. For those of you who may have missed SE Scoops Live, if you live in another country, there's a big time zone difference, or you were working, you couldn't join us, the episode is now up. It is actually up in iTunes. So if you are a subscriber, you probably already have it. And if you don't, you can subscribe now. It is titled The Return of SE Scoops Live. I posted it up, I think, on Thursday. It finally went up in the iTunes store. So you can subscribe and check that out. And if you would be so kind, please leave a review for the show on iTunes as well. It always is very helpful to us if you do that. So I appreciate it. So that's going to be it for episode 217 this week. I am the Solomonster. I thank you, as always, for joining me and making this show what it is. We'll be back next weekend with episode 218. I guess we'll find out what they do this week if Brock Lesnar makes an appearance. I would expect Brock to not be on Raw just because he's making an awful lot of appearances on TV for a guy who's only signed to do a minimum number of dates. And I would think that after what he did to Triple H last Monday, and supposedly he is now fired until they figure out a way to bring him back, I would not expect Lesnar on TV, but stranger things have happened. Hey, John Cena was supposed to go on vacation, and that lasted all of 24 hours, so who the hell knows? Till next time, be well, stay safe, we'll see you right back here next week. Take it easy, guys.
Let me tell you something, fella.
This is Joel from Northern Ireland.
Hi, I'm AJ Grimaldo.
And quite simply, the fastest 60 minutes on the internet.
The Solomonster sounds off on SEScoops.com.